Okay, one other thing I should say, so far as sitting further up front, I don't want to be a harpy person. At the same time, y'all do so good when you're encouraged, it's hard not to keep encouraging you if you have to. So, I don't know, maybe you have to help me hit the balance there too. Okay, I'm going to let y'all help me here today. It's a smaller group than sometimes. So, first off, what is the first, or some people call it the great, I don't know if it's accurate to say the greatest, that's the word I tend to use. The commandment. What's the first or great commandment? I think is how the words the Bible would use. Anyone?
Love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength.
Okay. And what is the second like to it?
Thou shalt love thy neighbor.
Okay, thank y'all. Now, just what about this verse? Matthew chapter 5, verse 19, Jesus talking says, whosoever there shall therefore shall break one of these least or small or lesser commandments and shall teach men so, he shall be called the least or the lesser in the kingdom of heaven. But whosoever shall do and teach them, referring to what he's referring to as the least commandments here, the same shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. So is it consistent to say some commandments are first or come first and others are less in importance, or what do you think? In other words, may we say one commandment is greater than another?
Well, if you take the commandment that says you love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and body, the rest tend to fall in place. So are the other ones less important? Well, you take some of the other commandments and they're not going to completely rule your life like that one will.
Okay. I think you covered it well. It's not necessarily that we're saying the others are not important by saying this is the first or great commandment, but we are saying that if you had to choose one commandment in the Bible that expressed the whole desire of God, the whole spirit of the law, it would be that commandment to love the Lord thy God with all thy. Well, now I'm getting lost here. Why don't we turn to Matthew chapter 12, verse 28 is the one I'm going to use. There's actually three. Matthew and Luke have one as well. The Lord our God is one Lord. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, with all thy mind, with all thy strength. So if you had to pick one thing, somebody would come to you and say, what, so far as laws, rules in the Bible, what are they really for? You could tell them that it's to help you do this, and that would be an accurate statement. The whole purpose of the law is to help you do this. If you completely follow the spirit of this, it covers everything else. So let's just read Mark chapter 12, verse 28 through 34. Mark 12, 28. And one of the scribes came, and having heard them reasoning together, and perceiving that he had answered them well, talking of a previous question that Christ answered, asked him, Christ, which is the first commandment of all? And Jesus answered him, the first of all the commandments is, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord, and thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, and with all thy mind, and with all thy strength. This is the first commandment. And the second one is like or similar, namely this, thou shalt love the neighbor as thyself. There is none other commandment greater than these. And the scribe said unto him, Well, master, thou hast said the truth, for there is one God, and there is none other but he, and to love him with all thy heart, and with all thy understanding, and with all the soul, and with all the strength, and to love his neighbor as himself is more than the whole burnt offerings and sacrifices. And when Jesus saw that he answered discreetly, or should we say wisely, he said unto him, Thou art not far from the kingdom of God, and no man after that durst ask him any questions. So for a title this morning, I was more specifically, when the suggestion was given, how to make this command practical. So I just called this Applying the Great Commandment. So let's look at the first commandment, what's called the first commandment here. Love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, and with all thy mind, and with all thy strength. Okay, now one of the children should be able to tell me this. What is the very important three-letter word in this this command? It's used a number of times. A very important three-letter word.
Love.
all. You know, does this, the word all, does this let any for me or someone else? So if I love God with all my heart, is there any heart left for to share with my wife, for example? Or how do you look at that? You're supposed to love God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, all your strength. Another question is this all, can I say, exclusive or inclusive? Now let me describe those words. Probably the mental image I get of exclusive is two people huddled off in a corner by themselves, and everybody else is excluded from their circle, right? They're over there by themselves. And if anybody comes, they make it pretty clear they would like for you to go somewhere else. That's exclusive. They are exclusive. Inclusive is when you have two, three people visiting and a fourth one walks up, the circle just automatically makes up for them and they're included. So I just maybe should write those words up here because we do want to think about them a bit. So is all exclusive or inclusive in this case? That is a trick question, so I don't really mind that anybody's too scared to answer it because it's both technically. And I'll describe what I mean by that. We generally view all as exclusive, and what I mean by that is if I don't have any money on me, but if I had some money and I gave Nathan all my money, he would have it all, right? I wouldn't have any left. I'd be at zero, or worse than zero. Nathan would have everything that I'm positively worth. He would have. So that's generally how we consider all, and that's right. If we give God all, he has everything. To a degree, that's a correct way to look at it. That's none left for myself. At the same time, it is still inclusive in that as I give God my all, there is still plenty left to give to proper and right relationships, for example. It still lets me have a heart for my wife. It's not that as I give God my whole heart that there's none left for my wife and children, because those are proper things that God has given me. But the thing that's important with them is priority. So in good things, let's just call them good, it's inclusive, but it also comes back to priority. Now, there are things where giving all to God is exclusive. And that would, of course, be things that are evil. And we could make a whole list of them. Pride, selfishness of various expressions, or we could maybe just say improper relationships, as I was talking about earlier, where if I give myself completely to God and I love him with all and in each of these senses, it still allows me to have a heart for my wife, for my daughters. At the same time, as I give God my all in the evil sense, it is exclusive in that there's no part left to give to an improper relationship because I'll begin to get given to God, right? And so that's how that works. Now, thinking a bit further down this line here, there's a few other words we need to clarify maybe as we look at this. If you're still there in Mark chapter 12, we have heart. Do any of you remember, I had a message here on the tripartite being, it's been a little while. Any of you remember what the heart, what some other words are that we could use for heart? Actually, it means the center of us is the center of a being. In this case, it's meaning the affections, what you love, what you care for, okay? It's not necessarily talking about the organ that's pumping blood, but it means what you have affections for. Then there's soul. Does anybody remember that one? Soul actually directly translated would be breath. So the soul of man was created when God breathed, so that's where that comes from. And so as soul is used in this context, it actually means our spirit, that which brings life and purpose. We'll let that mind here does not mean the physical brain. It's our thoughts, the understanding, and our imagination, and then our strength. Strength, what do you think of when you think of strength? Normally, I tend to think of muscles or horsepower or something that can move another object, right? Well, strength includes that, but it includes more. It also would include just any physical capability, talent, or energy that I have to accomplish things. So back to the question, how do you go about obeying the first commandment? How do you love God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength? There's a verse in Titus 1, verse 16. You don't need to turn to that one. It says this about a group of people. It says, they profess that they know God, but in works they deny him, being abominable and disobedient and unto every good work reprobate. Now, I was talking about the Cretans, if you go back and look at the context. Are there any of those Cretans left today? Would you say there's any Cretans in the world today? I'm not talking about actual Cretans, but people that are like this. They profess that they know God, but in their works they deny him. Is there people like that today? What do y'all say? Okay. Now, another question, and don't be scared to just give the right answer. Am I personally, I'm talking of myself, in any danger of being a person like this? I am. I have that potential within myself just as the Cretans did. It wasn't restricted to a certain nationality. Okay. So think about this. As we think about this command, now we're bringing up, we have the first command and then we have the second command, and I want to give you an illustration to try to help, at least in my mind, understand why these are tied so closely together. I text one of my friends this morning and asked him if I could talk about him, and he said I could. He said he'll try to trust me. So here goes. I told him I hope this would be mutual. I didn't see if he responded to that or not, but so I'm going to talk about Joel Schrock just a little bit. So he's probably one of what I would call one of my closer long-distance friends. So, okay, I see him occasionally, but I don't see him a lot, right? So how do I show love for him as a friend with him living in Oregon and me in Arkansas and we relating very, at most, couple of weeks out of the year? How can I show love to a friend like that? Anyone? Okay, thank you. These are not really related to this, so I'll just draw a line. Staying in touch, so I'm going to go up here. I'm going to write direct. So you can do that by a text, by a birthday card, by a call, by a lot of ways. Any form of communication or travel that you can go and be there with your friend is direct, okay? If I go and I come talk to you, that's direct. And so if I send him a text, email, if I send him a card or a letter, even if I pray for him, or if I even travel there to support him in something, that's all direct ways of relating to my friend and expressing or showing my love and appreciation for him, okay? Now, there is one other way I could do it as well, that I could show love for one of my friends. Now, what's that outside of direct? Okay, that was included and I appreciate it. I probably would put that under direct. In a way, I'm talking to God about them, but with God being everything, it's still a direct thing for them. Anyone else?
Indirect would be honoring his precepts.
Okay. Okay, that's the other word. Thank you, Hope. We'll just put indirect up here. And you touched on a few good ones. There is indirectly, by not telling you bad stories about him, whether I know any or not. That would be one way. Like Hope mentioned, honor. I was thinking of maybe even another way that would definitely be included, but that almost verges on direct in some ways. But it would be also one other way of indirectly caring or showing love would be by caring for those he cares about, right? And the reason I asked him if I could use him is his dad, Jason, was here for meetings this spring. So, okay, I consider Jason a personal friend, so I'm not trying to indicate that anything I did nice for Jason was because of Joel. At the same time, it could have been. But thinking about that, I know that Joel has a high estimation of his father and that they enjoy working together and spending time together. So as such, even though if I encouraged Jason, even though, well, I was invited to his wedding here, so even though I go to his wedding, that's not per se for Joel. Not really. It's more in support of his dad. It could be there. But on the other hand, by doing that, I am indirectly also making an expression to Joel that I care about him through his father, if you want to follow that. And so when Jesus says, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy mind, or excuse me, with all thy soul, with all thy mind, and with all thy strength, and then turns around and says, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself, it directly ties these two together. You know, Christ is not like I sometimes am. I was visiting with a friend earlier, and he was asking me a bunch of questions, and I finally got the feeling like I was going into too much detail describing something he had asked me. You know, Christ wasn't that way. Christ didn't tack this thing on about thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself because he was kind of just rambling through his mind. No, he included it because it was a very necessary ingredient in this conversation. So therefore, the first commandment ties directly and brings the second, which is similar, equal to, or associated with the first. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. They are inseparable. So how do you love your neighbor as yourself? Let's talk about that a bit. I'm not going to read the story of the Good Samaritan. That would be an illustration of who your neighbor is. But how do I go about just loving my neighbors myself? Most of us don't travel around on donkeys and pick people out of ditches and take them to an inn and pay their bills. It's not an opportunity that has come my way. If it has yours, God bless you. But for the most part, how do I go about doing this? First off, let me ask you another question. Do you have a default? And for those, if that's too big a word for anybody, default is just your natural way. It doesn't take any effort. This is how you do it. So do we have any default towards self? Is our default towards self, or is it towards other people? So if you're taking care of somebody, does it take less thought to take care of yourself or to take care of someone else? Anyone? Unfortunately, I do too, Nathan. I don't know, maybe some. Afraid most of us do. So as we default, since our default position is to care about ourselves, it means that there's an obvious choice involved in caring for others. It will actually take obvious thought and deliberate planning to keep from having my natural default position seem as best, as the best plan, or as the way to go. I'll give you a good illustration of this. I've found this very fascinating, and it's not necessarily in a good way. It can be discouraging. But it's interesting how you can try to teach your children to share. Charles Hamilton told a story years ago about how his parents had this odd idea about sharing when he was a little boy. I think he was about 5. And he said he had this rocking horse, and they thought he should share this rocking horse with his sister, younger sister, and he said this rocking horse was a wild horse. So he said to really help keep the horse under control, he had to ride it with her. And he said the funny thing was the horse still would buck her off sometimes. And you know, I wish it would have stayed with the Hamiltons. We don't really have a rocking horse that's bucking people off at our house. But the fact of the matter remains that there's a real hesitancy, and maybe too much in the girl's dad's heart too sometimes, to really share. You know, sharing, I can tell them about sharing, and it's kind of like trying to get people to sit further up in church. They hear the words, but they really don't do it unless you make a pronounced effort to pound it into their head. And so they hear the words, but you almost think they just evaporate. It's kind of like boiling water. It's gone. And next time the child needs this lesson on sharing, it's like, where'd it go? I know I put it there, but it's not there anymore. And so you work on it. But what's been fascinating is as I now have 3 girls, I actually found that it doesn't disappear. It's still in there, but it's reserved for other people. Sharing is a wonderful idea if it's not mine that we're sharing. So for example, I'll use a simple illustration. One of my girls has a pack of candy. The other 2 think it's an excellent idea for her to share her candy with them. But she doesn't at the moment. Now you swap that around and give that pack of candy to one of the other girls, all of a sudden the thing turned completely around. Now sharing is a very excellent idea again by the one that didn't think it was, but not so much for the one that had a little while ago thought it was. And that's a little bit how we are. Other illustration would be in marriage. You know, God made us as men and women different, and some that ends up meaning that we desire things in marriage a little bit different. Sometimes maybe having a dripping water pipe or something fixed is a higher priority to my wife than it is to me, for example. It could be all kinds of stuff. And so you got to work together on that. If you just do your natural thing, what bugs my wife most about me, I'll just let it slide. And so, and the same way, that will kind of, unless she's very strong, start eroding her love for me, because after all, he doesn't really seem to care much about what bothers me. And so you see how this selfish thing. So back to the point. To really not be selfish, in other words, to really be a blessing to someone else takes deliberate thought. And I really think the reason Christ ties these two together is that how I love my neighbor is the ultimate test as to whether I love God or not. If I don't love my neighbor, we could go to John. It says, if a man say he love his brother whom he hath seen, or doesn't love his brother whom he hath seen, and yet claims to love God whom he hath not seen, he's a liar. Now, this is the context. I think I did this maybe a different way. Again, this is not connected, but we have this thing of, we like to put, probably most of us would accept the being as God, someone we want to love and serve. And that's not too hard when you're, that's just between God and myself. That's easy. After all, what is to test that? Just to go back to the analogy, it's not a big test necessarily overall for me to get along with Joel, because quite frankly, we don't have a lot of communication. And so it's easy to get a supporting text or to remember something about someone. That's not a big deal. But when you're put in close contact, let's say Joel had a relative that lived here, and he actually has a few of these that would probably be a bit stressful to live closely with. And so I would say, well, you know what, this your relative here is, I just don't get along with this person. I'm going to shove them away. But yes, I'm still going to be good friends with you. Well, maybe you can say it depends on Joel's maturity, whether that works or not, but technically, that doesn't really work long term. And as we look at God, he gives others to us as our gauge of our relationship with him. And if I say there's a break here, I'm going to cut those off, but I'm going to maintain a good relationship with God. I've just undermined the fundamental way that I can see whether I'm right with God or not. Okay, so let's consider how to apply the first commandment in the context of direct and indirect ways that love for God is shown, and also remember the inclusive and exclusive. So love God with all your heart. I'm going to take this phrase by phrase, this verse. Love God with all your heart. So another way of saying this is, where are your affections? What do you love? Matthew chapter 10, verse 37 says it very clearly. He that loveth father or mother more than me is not worthy of me, and he that loveth son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. Love for God, like I told you earlier, is not exclusive in that which has a proper place in God's plan. So it's great to have love for father, mother, wife, children. That's all great and important. At the same time, if I get my order of importance wrong, and I got number one, and I got number two, and three, and four. Now, all of us would say we keep God number one, right? Well, the fact of the matter is, that doesn't always happen. Sometimes we put somebody else up there. Probably the biggest temptation is ourselves. For love for God is not exclusive to that which has a proper place in God's plan. Yet even in this, there's an order of importance. So God has to come first. He has to be of the highest priority. If this order of importance is disregarded, that which is not wrong in itself, the relationship, becomes wrong in importance. But this also means that love for God will exclude those affections from the heart that are not in his plan. And two, just briefly, I mentioned, is love for the world. If I have a heart for God and I have an affection for the things of God, it does not let room for affection for the world system. It also doesn't let room for impure relationships, like I mentioned earlier. And where our affections are tells an awful lot about us. Let me just read Luke chapter 12, verse 33 to 34 to you. It says, "Sell what you have, give alms, provide yourselves bags which wax not old, a treasure in the heavens that faileth not, where no thief approacheth, nor moth corrupteth, for where your treasure is, there will your heart be also." And that's often kind of hit me pretty hard. Where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. You know, it's a cause and effect. So often, at least for myself, it'd be kind of fun to say my treasure's in heaven, right? Or I should say my heart's in heaven, is what I meant to say. But yet, how do I relate? Everyday life displays where my treasure really is. Do I have time for people? Do I have money to help others that have needs? Or is my treasure here on this earth? It says, where my treasure is, there will my heart be also. I can't separate those two as much as we as human beings would like to. I had to think of a poem. I think we read this in school when I was going to school. I'll read this for the children as much as anyone. But for the rest of you, think a bit about how we must look to God sometimes. "Which loved her best" by Anonymous. "I love you, mother," said little John. Then forgetting his work, his cap went on, and he was off to the garden swing, leaving his mother the water and the wood to bring. "I love you, mother," said little Nell. "I love you better than tongue can tell." Then she teased and pouted full half the day, till her mother rejoiced when she went to play. "I love you, mother," said little Fan. "Today I help you all I can. How glad I am that school doesn't keep." So she rocked the baby till it fell asleep. Then stepping softly, she took the broom and swept the floor and tidied the room. Busy and happy all day she was, helpful and happy as a child could be. "I love you, mother," again they said, three little children going to bed. How do you think that mother guessed which of them really loved her best? Affections of the heart produce a fruit in the life. You can't separate that. The affections of my heart will produce a fruit in my life. Whatever that affection is it for God? It's going to produce a fruit that will show God at work. If it's for myself or anything else of this world, it will produce a fruit that lines up with that. You know, my affections are what determines whether or not I have time for personal time with God. And I'm saying this to myself, but really, if I struggle with getting my personal devotions in as I should, what does it really point to? It points to a heart that's not really has God on the top of the list. Something else is on top, whatever that might be. My affections are what determines whether or not I have time for others. My affections are what determines whether or not I bear witness to Christ and his work in me, or I just rush throughout my day. My affections are what determines whether or not I'm critical of others and tear them down through gossip or whatever. Or my affections also determine whether I see God at work, even though there might be big needs in the life. My affections are what determines whether I plant seeds of trust and encouragement or of doubt and discouragement. My affections say an awful lot about me. Now, I'd like, you can turn to this if you want, Matthew chapter 19. We have a famous man. We probably read some of these verses as much as any. But Matthew chapter 19, verse 16. We have this young rich man that comes to Jesus. And I want to just read that story, point out a few things about him. Matthew 19, verse 16. "And behold, one came and said unto him, Good master, what good thing shall I do that I may have eternal life? And he said unto him, Why callest thou me good? There is none good but one, that is God. But that thou wilt enter into life, keep the commandments. He saith unto him, Which? Jesus said, Thou shalt do no murder, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not bear false witness, honor thy father and thy mother, and thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. The young man saith unto him, All these things I have kept from my youth up. What lack I yet? Jesus said unto him, If thou wilt be perfect, go and sell what thou hast and give to the poor, and thou shalt have treasure in heaven, and come and follow me. I don't know what you see, but as I read this story, I don't see a man that was lacking in actions. He was not lacking in actions. In fact, he said, and nobody really contradicted him, all these things I did from my youth up. So I feel he was doing things for his neighbors. He was honoring his parents, at least in a way. He was living this up to a degree. But he lacked an inward affection. He seems to have been looking for an action he could do. Notice the first thing he said, "Good master, what good thing shall I do?" You know, it's not what we do. It's who we give all. So he says, "What good thing can I do?" And Jesus touched the one thing he could not do without loving God with all his heart. You know, unless somebody loves God with all their heart, there is absolutely no way they're going to give everything to God. And that's why I feel Christ specifically laid this directive out to this young man was he saw that this young man was saying, "Oh, I'm doing this all." Yet in reality, he was not. He totally missed the spirit of what God really wanted. And so Christ, by telling him, "Go sell everything you have and give it to the poor and come and follow me," he touched that place in that young man's heart that showed that young man that as much as I was thinking I had it given all up, I didn't. It wasn't all given up. He had an affection, and he thought he could honor his parents, and he thought he could love his neighbors, and he thought he could do no murder, and he thought he wasn't bearing false witness. But as soon as that point in his heart touched that he was unwilling to give up, it all of a sudden became clear to him that, hey, I'm a totally different person than what I thought I was. I was thinking I'm something, when in reality, I've not been doing any of those things. Because guess what? If everything he had was given to Christ, it would have been there for the neighbors before he sold it. Christ's request showed him the true condition of his heart. And he went away sad because his delusion of perfection was revealed. And I don't know, you think about this. Maybe I haven't thought this through clearly enough. But may I suggest that each one of us has some area in our heart that needs to be sold and given away so that we can follow Christ. And I think it's just as difficult as it was for this young man. I'm not necessarily suggesting that all of us have to do exactly what was asked of this young man. But I am suggesting that every one of us has some area in our heart that blocks us from following Christ. And Christ wants to touch that area and take away our delusion that we're living good, when in reality, there's something blocking his work in our life. Affections produce fruit. Okay, the next one. Love God with all your soul. So as we love God with all our soul, breath, okay? So what gives you life and purpose? Let's describe it this way. How many of you sit around and are like, "I better take a breath in the next 10 seconds again"? I don't think anybody here does. If you do, you're fairly abnormal, in case you didn't know. I just take a breath when I need it, or at least for the most part. And I hope I'm in a place where I'm kind of scared of water, and that's one reason why I like to breathe when I need to. A breath, we're not sitting here. Okay, I took a breath. Let's see. How many seconds ago was that? Now I need another one here in time. No, actually, it takes deliberate effort not to breathe. So just as we do not put effort into breathing, if we love God with our whole being, and he is our life, he's our purpose, our actions will subconsciously be dictated by the desire that God has for us. And I'm not trying to indicate that our flesh is totally gotten rid of, that we don't have a fight. Please understand me. There is a deliberate action. At the same time, as I walk with Christ, as I give my all to Christ, and I'm living completely for him, it will, more and more as we give ourselves to Christ, become an act of God in us. And I have to, I guess one of the, amazingly enough of all things, he was a young man, that is probably one of the best examples of this. And that's kind of interesting because we often think, well, yeah, that's great for the old Christian that's lived 20 years. Well, this man lived in the old covenant and he was a young man. And thankfully was named after him, I guess. But you know, when he was tempted, he did not need to stand there and deliberate. When he was tempted by Potiphar's wife, he wasn't there like saying, You know, would this be all right? Could I somehow make this all right? After all, I'm pretty lonely. I'm here all by myself. You know, he didn't do any of that. He didn't say, now, is this temptation too strong? Is she too beautiful? Or whatever else he could have thought. Is the temptation too tempting? He didn't do any of that. He was instant. There was no deliberation needed. It was because his whole breath was to do the will of God. He said, how can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? And the next verse it tells us, he hearkened not unto her. And in the next few verses he says, he left, fled, and got himself out. You know, he didn't fool around. Because as his response in that first verse showed, how can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? His every motive, the whole thing he had deliberately decided, that whatever I do is done for God. And that's how he served God with all of his soul. And I could see Joseph very easily saying these verses along with Jesus in John chapter 4, verse 34. Jesus said unto them, my meat, or what keeps me going in life, is to do the will of him that sent me and to finish his work. John 6, verse 38. For I came down from heaven, not to do mine own will, but the will of him that sent me. And so you want to make this practical in your life, how to serve God with all your soul. It's to have everything you do to be working towards one end. It doesn't mean that you never sweep the floor. It doesn't mean that you don't clean out the truck. It doesn't mean that you don't build a shop or a mini barn or do whatever work God has for you. But it means that your goal in doing those mundane tasks are all for the kingdom of heaven's sake. And not for just increasing my bank account. Not just to make me feel big. Not to make me feel important. Not to somehow get prestige and whatever else we can gather around us down here. Is it life and breath to me to do God's will? Is it life and breath to me to help others for God? Do I see all I am and all I have as given to me for God and his kingdom? Something that's simply been given so I can return it back to God and just let him use it. Okay, the next phrase. Love God with all your mind. And again, I told you that's not the physical brain, but our mind. Where are your thoughts? Maybe where are your thoughts right now? What are you thinking about? This don't necessarily have to be listening to me. That's not what I'm trying to indicate. But are your thoughts about God, about what he wants in you? Or are they about something that's going to be gone in a couple days, a couple years? What seeds of understanding and or imagination are do you cultivate in your life? Matthew 24, verse 28, Christ said, and it's talking a little different context, but it's very true in relation to our thoughts. It says, for wheresoever the carcass is, that's the dead body, there will the eagles or the buzzards, vultures, be gathered together. For where my thoughts are, that is who I become. I can't pretend that, oh, I'm going to have these thoughts over here and I'm going to keep these in my closet and nobody's ever going to find out what I think about in my spare time. Yet over here, I'm projecting something totally else. Guess what? That closet door pops open when you least expect it and reveals the true person. There's a saying Dad used to say, and it's kind of complicated, so I don't know. I'll say it. Maybe you can catch it. He liked to play on these words. You are not what you think you are, but what you think you are. In other words, you aren't what you often like to pump up in our own mind, myself, first of all. We sometimes like to kind of paint a rosy picture about ourselves. You know, we do this, we do that. We'd hate to make ourselves feel too bad, wouldn't we? Or maybe we have the reverse and just put ourselves down in the dumps. That's actually the same problem, just a different way of relating. And so maybe I make myself either bad or good and I do all this to myself. And that's what I'm thinking. You are not what you think you are, but what you think you are. So in other words, if I'm always thinking about self, whether raising it up or lowering it, whether I'm always thinking about how to make the next dollar, whether I'm always thinking about what others think about me, that's what I become. Either greedy, selfish, self-conscious person. If, on the other hand, I find God's grace and strength to fill that need in my life, and I think about him, his word, his plan, what he wants to do, and the glorious opportunity he's given me to serve him, that's what I become in him. Luke chapter 6, verse 45 says this, and a good man out of the good treasure of his heart bringeth forth that which is good. And I know it uses heart there, but mind is the same way. And an evil man out of the evil treasure of his heart, mind, bringeth forth that which is evil. For of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaketh. And it's amazing how true this is. We had a neighbor, and he was a real good neighbor there in Kentucky. He's passed away a number of years ago, but he was not a Christian. And around our family, we had something to do with him. He could talk as, no foul language, no nothing. It was good. You would have never had a problem with what he said, for the most part. At the same time, you would catch him with a neighbor. There was words coming out of that mouth you had absolutely no clue would be in there. But you know what was, it's not funny, I'm not sure what I should call it, interesting, is as much as good as he was at it, sometimes he would forget himself and embarrass himself something awful. But you know, what's in the inside comes out. If you're thinking those words will come out. If you're thinking whatever you're hiding in your heart will sooner or later pop to the surface. And even if it doesn't, God knows it's there. You know, most thoughts, we're told, people think are about themselves up to 80%. And that's either direct or indirectly. They say that, do research, watching thoughts, they say people think 80% of the time about themselves, and that's either thinking directly about myself or wondering, what is so-and-so thinking about me? Okay, so that lets very little for other stuff, doesn't it? So, thoughts of self, self-promotion, self-worth, of how others perceive me, whether these are feeling, like I said, if these are feelings of superiority or inferiority, they're still about self, and that's what matters. Another thing is imaginations. I see some people that maybe in their spiritual life, they say, well, I don't really sense a deep peace in my life, even though I tried to follow what God wants. So I imagine that there must be something wrong, even though I don't know. Or maybe I'm struggling with faith. And so rather than asking God for more faith, I focus on the struggle for faith, and all of a sudden I'm like, you know, I must be a bad person because there's no faith there. Imagination. Another thing, and hopefully you don't struggle with this one, but maybe you see two of your friends or two brothers or sisters in church, see somebody talking together off in a corner quite a while by themselves. And you're like, what are they talking about? They're probably talking about me. Oh yeah, you know, I did that dumb thing the other week or whatever, and they must be talking about me. That's what's going on. They're gossiping about me. Or maybe it just seems like, and I, please don't misunderstand me here, where I haven't made an effort to visit with people as I should, I'm sorry for that. I'm no way am justifying that. At the same time, if I'm going through life and I notice that, I've been at church the last 3 weeks for every church, every Sunday morning service, every evening service that we had, and Johnny just didn't talk to me any of those services. I think he's got something against me. He's hiding something about me, and I start wondering what this is, and I start inventing all kinds of things. Imagination. Or maybe we got a brother or sister in the church that has some concerns that, be kind of nice if they wouldn't, or at least, if they keep them to themselves, if the least. And so maybe I get shared with a time or two about a need in my life. And next thing you know, I start imagining, she seems to always be harping on this one certain area. I wonder, I think they've got something hidden in their life. That's why they always picking on that one. Imagination. I'm not saying imaginations are all wrong. Some of these wrong imaginations may be right in their context, actually, but does that make them right? Okay. If I love God with all my mind, the thoughts I think and the imaginations I allow will all be for the building of his kingdom. My thoughts will be thoughts of the wonder that God could love a sinner like me and that he saved me. Thoughts of, how can I bring glory to God today? And in the same way with my imagination, it doesn't just stop with thought in that way. But my imagination will be put to positive use. You know, it will be used for making the sharing of God and his word and work an interesting and alive experience for those who listen. The imagination will be used for when I see two brothers or two sisters off in the corner spending a lot of time talking. A good imagination there is, I'm so blessed that those two people can bless each other for whatever the need is there. Or maybe Johnny doesn't get around to visiting with me, and I think, wow, I'm just glad he's so busy visiting with other people. He doesn't have time for me. That's awesome. Great. He's helping other people. Or when I'm shared a concern with, I'm so blessed to be part of a church where people care about things, even when I don't totally follow their train. And maybe it doesn't, it's not a big a deal. But I can still be blessed. You know, they care about me. And there, let me tell you, there's nothing scarier than talking to somebody. So at least maybe they loved you enough. Use your imagination in a positive way. Philippians 4, verse 7 through 8 are some verses I'd like to let with you on this thought. And the peace of God, which passeth all understanding, shall keep your hearts and minds through Christ Jesus. Finally, brethren, whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are honest, whatsoever things are just, whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are lovely, whatsoever things are of good report, if there be any virtue, if there be any praise, think on these things. Let me go back to verse 7 there and tell you a little bit about this. That word keep, as I understand, is, I think it's the only time in the New Testament that that word keep is used. And it actually has the thought, the Greek word, has a connotation of setting an armed guard around this. Just like sending 1,000 Roman soldiers to stand around the church house so nothing can come in that shouldn't. So think about this. And the peace of God, which passeth all understanding, shall keep your hearts and minds through Christ Jesus. And I tell you, I still struggle. I don't want to indicate this is all past. But as a late teens, early 20s there, when I had some real struggles in my thought life, this verse has just meant so tremendously much to me to know that as I come to God, I just give Him everything and I really rely on Him and let Him fight the battle for me. He's going to set a guard around me that cannot be penetrated as long as I stay where I need to be stay. It's beautiful, wonderful. Okay. The last one, love God with all your strength. Love God with all your strength. Remember, we're not talking about just muscles. What do you do with the natural abilities you have? Now, if you relate to people long enough, you'll bump into some people that think they have no natural abilities. I shouldn't say that. And that's not true. If you don't think you have any, you probably just haven't looked hard enough. I'm not saying some don't have more than others. At the same time, God has a place every one of us can fill. So, do you use your natural abilities, talents, and energy to pursue things, exaltation of self, and things of this life? Or do you use your natural abilities, talents, and energy to further God's kingdom and His work? And along with that, how can I, if I really am a Christian, I desire to use my natural abilities, talents, and energy for God, how do I do that? How can I really make use of my natural abilities, talents, and energy for God and His kingdom? I'm going to ask you next question is, isn't this done through service to others? Mainly? Isn't this done by as I use what God has given me, whatever that is? Maybe it's just two ears that I can listen with. I think about everybody has two ears they can hear with here at least. And there's a tremendous need of people just listening to other people. So are you using your ears for the kingdom of heaven? Notice Matthew chapter 25, verse 40, another verse I read not so long ago. And it says, and the king shall answer and say unto them, verily I say unto you, inasmuch as ye have done it unto the least of these my brethren, ye have done it unto me. So how many of you would gladly spend an afternoon listening to Christ talk? I think all of us, right? So what about the person that needs a listening ear? Are you there? Can they use your ears if they need it? What do almost all older people, and I'm classifying that as 70 and over, so I don't think we have hardly any here if I'm right, but anyways. If you go older like that, 70 and older, what's one thing most of them have in common to a degree? Some do more, some less, but I don't know, the ones I bump into like to sit around and think about how it was, the past, right? How their life has, their experiences, whether good or bad. Some are very positive. They have, and that's great. I have no problem with it. But almost all older people are happy to share on their pasts, depending on their temperament and their outlook. It depends whether you get a lot of pessimism or a lot of good stories. But that said, they almost all do it. And here's, I don't know if you've ever thought about this. For some reason, it's something I've thought more, maybe as I hit my 30s. But you know, someday, unless God takes me home before then, I'm going to be that old person, that 70, 75, sitting around, can hardly do anything but sit on his chair. And I don't think I'll be unique. I think I'll probably be there talking about how it was. I do. But here's the question that kind of scares me, if I can say it. I don't want to living in fear. But when I get that age, and what I can best do is sit around on that chair and think back over it all, how can I have the least regrets with how I've used my life, my time, and what God has given me? Ecclesiastes 9:10 says, "Whatsoever thy hand findeth to do, do it with thy might, for there is no work, nor device, nor knowledge, nor wisdom in the grave whither thou goest." And I think Ecclesiastes 9 verse 10 is never more true or better done when it's done in helping others because we love God and we want to love him with all our strength. As we just give God all our strength, all we can do. Here's a poem. I thought I had maybe used it here. My wife wasn't sure I had, so I'll read it, and it won't damage us permanently if I have. I think this was C.T. Studdard, maybe was his name. Okay, two little lines I heard one day, traveling along life's busy way, bringing conviction to my heart, and from my mind would not depart. Only one life 'twill soon be past, only what's done for Christ will last. Only one life, yes, only one, soon will its fleeting hours be done. Then in that day my Lord to meet and stand before his judgment seat. Only one life, 'twill soon be past, only what's done for Christ will last. Only one life, the still small voice gently pleads for a better choice, bidding my selfish aims to leave and to God's holy will to cleave. Only one life, 'twill soon be past, only what's done for Christ will last. Only one life, a few brief years, each with its burdens, hopes, and fears, each with its clays I must fulfill, living for self or in his will. Only one life, 'twill soon be past, only what's done for Christ will last. When this bright world would tempt me sore, when Satan would a victory score, when self would seek to have its way, then help me, Lord, with joy to say, only one life, 'twill soon be past, only what's done for Christ will last. Give me, Father, a purpose deep, in joy or sorrow thy words to keep, faithful and true, whate'er the strife, pleasing thee in my daily life. Only one life, 'twill soon be past, only what's done for Christ will last. Oh, let my love with fervor burn, and from the world now let me turn, living for thee and thee alone, bringing thee pleasures on thy throne. Only one life, 'twill soon be past, only what's done for Christ will last. Only one life, yes, only one. Now let me say, thy will be done. And when at last I hear the call, I know I'll say 'twas worth it all. Only one life, 'twill soon be past. Only what's done for Christ will last. Only one life, 'twill soon be past. Only what's done for Christ will last. And when I am dying, how happy I'll be if the lamp of my life has burned out for thee.